You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. In 2014, Canada passed Bill C-36, the Conservative Party's Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act. The bill was meant to criminalize pimps, johns, and brothel owners, but in much of Canada, progressive governments have refused to enforce that law. As such, the exploitation continues. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has promised to repeal the legislation, threatening to fully decriminalize prostitution in Canada, though this has yet to come to fruition. In general, the issue of prostitution in Canada has been left uncovered. The debate in the public sphere tends to center around questions of women's choices. The left chants sex work is work in an effort to frame the problems in the sex trade as revolving around labor standards. Meanwhile, the men who pay for sex and the men who exploit women in the trade are ignored. In order to better address the reality of the sex industry in Canada, Andrea Hines and Kathy King teamed up and wrote a book. When Men Buy Sex, Who Really Pays? Looks at Canadian stories of women in prostitution, how they ended up in the trade, what happened to them there, why men buy sex, how to curb demand, and more. I spoke with them both over the phone about their research and about how we can change minds and legislation to better address exploitation and abuse in the sex trade. Hello, Andrea and Kathy. Thank you so much for joining me on the Feminist Current podcast. I'm looking forward to having a conversation with you both.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you so much.
Before we get into the book, I'd love to hear a little bit about both of your stories. Kathy, I wonder if you can start by telling us a little bit about your interest in this issue and why it is that you co-wrote this book with Andrea.
Well, my story goes back over 25 years when I had a very troubled teenage daughter who became involved in a lot of things that I didn't understand. She was not unlike a lot of teens, got involved with drugs. Her drugs led to psychotic episodes. She spent time in hospital. So between her drug use and her hospitalizations, she was very vulnerable, and she had a lot of friends who didn't have her best interests at heart. And she became involved in a lot of things I didn't understand. And she disappeared from the streets of Edmonton in August of 1997. So I had a few years prior to that of struggling with, you know, how to deal with a young adult who's basically dealing with drugs. That was all new to me. And then when she disappeared, of course, that was probably the turning point of my life. And she was missing for a month, and then her body was found in a field outside of Edmonton. And I think what hurt me most at the time was the way she was labeled by the media as there was the stigma that was applied, the names and the labels that were applied to her as a body that was found were just shocking and horrifying. And it just made me realize how vulnerable young people like her are still, and just how unfair it was, and how she was being blamed and labeled for things that people had done to her, and when she was the one that was struggling with so many issues. And so that began a 25-year journey for me. I mean, I had been advocating prior to her disappearing because I was trying to organize resources for her. I was trying to be, I thought, a responsible parent, and trying to sort of weave my way through this difficult path of dealing with addictions and homelessness and hospitalizations and all of those things. And then afterwards I thought, well, there's nobody that can, you know, nobody can hurt us anymore. So I'm just going to start talking about the bigger issues. And I have been for over 25 years. So that's what started me on the journey. Some of the experiences I had 25 years ago are being repeated today, I think, in various ways. And so it's not a 25-year-old issue. It's still a current issue. It's still something that I think society needs to sort of look to take a different perspective on. And so I've met many, many exited women, many survivors over the last while. I became involved with the in Edmonton with the Sex Trade Offender Program, which is aka the John School. And I've been doing that for 25 years as an educator and helping run that program, not really run the program, but participate in the program. And that's led me to meet many, many more people who, you know, so I'm always delighted and inspired to hear from people who've survived, who were able to break the cycle and, you know, who came out of that kind of exploitation. And so when Andrea approached me a couple years ago about writing a book, I said, sure, I'm in. And 2 years later, here we are. So almost ready for publication.
And of course the book is, it's called When Men Buy Sex, Who Really Pays? Canadian Real Stories is. Of Exploitation, Survival and Advocacy. I'm presuming, you know, was your daughter involved in prostitution?
Yes. Yes, yes. And I tend not to use that word, but as part of her homelessness and part of her drug addiction, and she was exploited. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, we've spoken before on the podcast, I know, about your story, but for those listening who aren't familiar, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your interest in this issue, the reason or some of the reasons you wanted to work on this book?
Sure, thank you. And thanks so much for having me back on. I'm always happy when we connect as like-minded women. So for me, my journey hasn't been quite as long as Kathy's. I am now in, I want to say my 17th year of being fully submerged in this conversation. The last 10 years have been activism, sex trade abolition activism. And that basically came about as a result of me spending 7 years in the commercial sex industry, which I entered as a 22-year-old woman who was coming out of a long string of emotionally and physically and mentally abusive relationships and $60,000 of debt that was largely incurred because of those relationships, as well as financial illiteracy, lack of education, and all the things that we see that are pretty characteristic of young women still to this day. Like Kathy said, a lot of the same things replicating. So from 22 to 29, I spent time in the sex industry here in Edmonton, Alberta, where we have a licensed and regulated regime. So that was my involvement, was in quote unquote sex work, or what people would refer to as such, always licensed and regulated escorting and brothel systems, and also traveling internationally with men who were quite affluent, that were doctors and lawyers and other professionals. And so for the time that I was in the industry, for the most part, I identified as a sex worker. I thought that I was autonomous, that I was there based on my own free will, that I made a choice. But now looking back and with kind of a new radical lens that I've acquired through, post-secondary education, understanding violence against women, hearing the stories of other women, of family members such as Kathy, and just kind of that broader perspective, I can now look back and recognize that there's a distinction between a choice and a decision. And I really can't say now that I ever actually chose to be in the commercial sex industry, but rather decided to based on a lack of choices. Because when you're working 5 part-time jobs and you're struggling and you can just not dig out of that cycle of poverty, it's very easy to get lured into the sex industry when you see the portrayal of it as such a romanticized, glorified activity. And then I'll also see the advertising all about that tells you and promises you of all this big money that you're going to make. So that was how I got sucked into the industry, was all of those precursors, but then seeing an ad in my local newspaper that said adult entertainment, make $2,000 a week. So about 5 years into 7 years of being in the industry, everything just kind of started tumbling for me mentally, the house of cards, so to speak. And that was really kind of what started moving me out of the industry and starting to see it in a different light. And now I just really, really want to debunk sex work ideology, because I think that so many young women are very susceptible to falling for it and being groomed and conditioned into it. And we really don't see a pushback on sex work ideology within media and within popular culture. So that was really kind of what spurred my wanting to do a book, is that there isn't a lot of literature out there that does debunk sex work ideology. There's a lot of content that supports it instead. And here in Canada, we have the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, which is our Nordic model style laws on purchasing sex, which decriminalizes the seller and criminalizes the purchaser. But presently, we're facing a lot of risk of that law being overturned. And we're on the doorstep of full decriminalization, which would allow pimps, profiteers, and johns to just have free rein on marginalized women. So I said to Kathy one day, Kathy, you know, there's really nothing out there, and we both like to write, so why don't we write a book? And it was perfect timing with COVID, and Kathy being ever eager, she was ready to go. And so the journey commenced, and it's been a really wonderful experience to partner with her on this project. We're hopeful it'll be impactful.
And in terms of the Canadian law, I was really happy when this law was passed that was similar to Sweden's Nordic model, which you explained earlier. But it also seemed like it wasn't enforced in Canada.
No.
What happened there?
Partly what happened is the government changed. The legislation was brought in under the Conservative government, and then we had an election shortly after that, and the Liberals campaigned against the legislation and have sort of written it off as partisan, which is very, very unfortunate. But that's basically what happened, is the Liberals came into power and have been in power since the year after the legislation passed. And they have chosen not to pay attention to the law, basically. They haven't overturned it yet, but there's been no serious attempt at developing it or developing it across Canada or engaging the provinces. That's maybe an oversimplification. What's your, Andrea?
No, that's totally, completely spot on. And I think part of the problem too is that one essential component to any Nordic model legislation is an increase in the social security net. So financial support to, you know, close that marginalization between men and women in society. And so the government did put a one-time amount of $20 million spread out over, I believe it was 4 or 5 years, to a select number of agencies and organizations. But, you know, really $20 million is not taking us anywhere far. And nothing else was done after that. So of course, then dissenters of the legislation always come back with, well, nothing has changed, nothing has worked. And there has been some research that has actually shown that we've seen less murders of women in prostitution, and that the law has been effective for when it has been applied, but there's been no universal endorsement or enforcement of it, particularly in very liberal pockets of Canada, such as Vancouver.
Right. So very frustrating. As I recall in Vancouver, what happened and what many of us in Vancouver fought against and tried to call out was that the VPD, the Vancouver Police, were actively not enforcing the law. You know, they and with the support of the mayor, Gregor Robertson, at the time, mm-hmm. refused to support the law that criminalized Johns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that continues now to still going on.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the language. You know, earlier when I was speaking with you, Kathy, you said you don't like to use the word prostitution and refer to your daughter as exploited. I don't use the term sex work. I'm curious to know what you both feel about the language surrounding the sex industry. Kathy, why don't you start?
Oh, my goodness. I call it the P word. I don't use the P word because it's been so overused. And the connotation, I think, is that the connotation seems to be that there's a reciprocity, that people are more or less equal partners, and that there is a payment, and that everything's sort of okay. And traditionally and culturally, women have been blamed. Women have been blamed for the actions of men. And so whenever there's any controversy, whenever there's any headline, it's not suspected, you know, body found, suspected John arrested. It's the other way around. And so the whole consciousness has been really anti-woman, anti-provider. And so I just find that word, it just needs to be dismissed from our language, and that the language needs to focus on who is doing what to whom. It's sort of like intimate partner violence. You know, it's most of the time it's men being violent towards women. So why are we covering it up with these sort of neutral words? So I prefer to use the word offender, sexual offenders, sexual exploiters, customer, I guess, or not even customer, consumer. Consumer is probably the most neutral word that I would use, sexual consumers, because it is the whole activity is based on men seeking services from women, consuming women, using women, utilize women, exploiting women, and trying to justify their behavior by payment, which is just another form of coercion in my perspective.
I've noticed, I've been engaged in this debate for a long time now, and I've noticed that most often the conversation is turned around onto the women. So when I criticize pornography or prostitution, people will say to me, well, women can make free choices. Like, what about women who want to do it? If a woman is a consenting adult and is choosing to be there, who are you to stop her? And it's frustrating because I'm like, I'm almost never talking about the women's choices. I'm usually talking about men's choices. And I'm not trying to stop women from doing anything.
Exactly. The conversation always turns to the women. You're exactly right. And that's what the one thing that we've really tried to do in our book is take the focus off the women. And it's going to be interesting over the next few months as we roll out the book, and I hopefully will be interviewed by more and more people, to see if we can keep putting the attention back on. We're not talking about women's choices, we're talking about men's choices. And it's not a healthy choice for the men of the world to want to consume sexual services from the women of the world. It's based on an economic imbalance. It's based on a gender imbalance. It's based on a social imbalance. It's just based on so many unhealthy systems that we really need to focus on the men of the world shifting their attitudes.
Andrea, how do you think the language that we use to describe the sex trade impacts our view and impacts conversations surrounding the sex trade?
I think language is very, very powerful. And I do echo and understand Kathy's reluctance to use prostitution. There was a quite a long period of time that I myself didn't use the term as well. But what I personally found, and maybe it's just because I'm much more active on Twitter and public-facing activism, whereas, you know, Kathy's doing a lot more great grassroots work with people in person. I had found that really shifting it to only speaking about exploitation, a lot of the times people didn't even understand what I was talking about. And again, I know that that's not necessarily a reason to modify our own language, but I just found for effectiveness purposes, there is a type of weight that is carried with the word prostitution, good and bad. Good in that people understand what it means, and that it does have a sting to it, that when women particularly hear that word, they don't like it, and they don't like what it makes them feel and what it makes them think of. And for me, my main issue is labor language. And I think it's the same for Kathy as well, too. We're very, very, very careful to not use any form of labor language within our book. So we don't use the term sex work, sex worker, client, any type of labor language. And if we did use it, it was always put into quotations just to show, if anything, the irony of what we're talking about when we're challenging the concept of coercive paid sex as a form of employment or labor. So for me, that's really my bottom line is labor language. Everything else, I can kind of take it or leave it. I don't personally use any type of labeling terms. So, you know, forgive me for using them now, but I don't use the term prostitute. I don't use the term hooker or anything like that that labels a woman. But when it comes to action words such as prostitution, I have found it's, for my work, a bit more effective to still continue use of that language until so far that the social awareness is moved further along so that people can understand what we're talking about when we just reference sexual exploitation.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly stay away from the term sex work for that reason, because it does sanitize the industry. It neutralizes what's going on. And I think that's the intention. I mean, sex work, so-called sex work in quotation advocates, industry advocates, advocates of legalization and of normalization and sanitization of prostitution and pornography say, you know, they direct people to use the term sex work because they say, you know, it's not stigmatizing. But I think that it is an industry that should be stigmatized. I think that it's an industry that is full of abuse and exploitation and violence and coercion and so on and so forth. And that's not something I want to tidy up.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
I think that there's more than one way that women and girls end up in the sex trade. And at the same time, I think that there's so much that we can learn and so much in terms of those stories that contextualize women in the industry, you know, how they get there and why is important. And again, that's often erased. You know, I just watched this new documentary on Netflix called Money Shot about the porn industry. And one of my great frustrations was that they spoke to a bunch of, I call them industry advocates, because they were, you know, some of them were performers, but they were invested in Pornhub. You know, they're making money off Pornhub. They were employees of Pornhub. They were essentially invested in trying to clean up the industry or make it appear in any case that the industry was not rife with trafficking and, you know, child rape videos. But none of them, you know, the producers and the director didn't ask any of them how they got into the industry or why. They didn't ask them any questions about what happened prior to this point where they are magically working in porn. And usually the stories are revealing. But you know much better than I. I mean, how do women end up in prostitution, for example?
Yeah, well, and I think so much of what you said is spot on, that it's almost like the unknown. It's a thing that nobody talks about. And a lot of times I found, too, that that wasn't even really discussed amongst women themselves in the industry. It was just almost sort of like everybody organically just appeared there, and it was all under the context of, oh, we're all just here because this is work and it's a job and we need money. And the longer that you would sit on the couch and you would speak with women in between, quote unquote, sessions with men, you would come to hear bits and pieces of the stories, and you could kind of piece it together then. But it's typically not something that people bring forth, because in doing so, then they are being vulnerable and talking about their hardships and their vulnerabilities and what has brought them there. And usually that's not anything positive. You know, it's, as we know, it's not the women, you know, coming out of law school that are all of a sudden just deciding to have a career shift and end up in the industry. So yeah, there's a lot of lack of transparency around entry causes. But I think, you know, the underlying entry reasoning, if you will, has always first and foremost been basically money and force, external third-party coercion and force. So I think that still to this day, that still probably rings fairly true, is that it's the socioeconomic marginalization of women that brings us there. But I think something that's kind of growing and has been since the introduction of sex work ideology since the 1980s or so, is that now it seems like youth have a little bit more of a shortcoming in understanding who they are as people themselves and their identity that really exists outside of any type of materialism. We are living in such a money-focused, materialistic world now that everything is all about not who you are as a core or at your core as a human being, but it's what you have and the external presentation of who you are, what you look like, what you own, how flashy you are. So I think what we're seeing now being introduced to these, you know, common things that have always been there, money and force, is the social contagion aspect that has come along since the introduction of sex work ideology. So now it's cool, you know, it's liberating to be in the industry. It's proof of one's non-judgmental nature, because as we all know, you can't judge anyone for anything at all anymore. We live in cancel culture. And so that's really what I've started noticing the most, is that really I didn't see that even whenever I entered in 2006, there wasn't this overwhelming sex work ideology narrative that created that social contagion effect. So now it's just very, very scary when you think about the young girls who are, you know, planning that, hey, as soon as I turn 18, I'm making an OnlyFans, or I'm going to be sugaring, I'm going to be making all this money, I'm for sure entering, I'm going to be dancing in the strip clubs. You didn't see that before. And so, yeah, I think that there's always going to be that economic and social component, but now it just seems like it's that contagion effect taking hold as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's endless marketing for the independent, empowered sex worker, right? Via Instagram and, of course, via OnlyFans, which sells this idea that, you know, you work for yourself, you can just work out of your apartment, you don't actually have to have sex with men, and you can make thousands and thousands of dollars. And it would seem appealing. It's all a lie, of course. Most money on OnlyFans make, most women on OnlyFans make next to nothing. You know, there's a very small number of women who make a lot. And as far as I'm concerned, those women are participating in exploitation also by trying to recruit other women to join the platform. But Kathy, you have a different experience in terms of what happened to your daughter and how she ended up in this situation where she was being exploited in the sex trade. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you've learned in researching and learning more about the sex industry, about how girls and women can end up in this place? Like, what's the reality of that story that's called, you know, a choice?
Yeah, and I'm sure it's still happening today too, that they're as teens go through this sort of rebellious rebellious period for whatever reason. And I honestly don't know. Well, no, my daughter did say she was some of the things that some of her experiences I still find hard to believe. Because I mean, at one time I found out after the fact, she said she was kidnapped from a mall. And I'm like, how do you get kidnapped from a mall? You know, and but apparently she did. And apparently she met somebody who convinced her or forced her, I don't know, whatever, and introduced her somehow, probably at that time. Well, I don't know if she was encouraged or forced to sell sex. She came home. She didn't talk about it like until much later. And then apparently another friend said to her, well, you know, you remember how you can make money. And so these undesirables that she considered her boyfriends at the time were encouraging her to sort of, I don't know what they were encouraging her to do, but to stand, you know, to make her own money. And that was, she was kind of a mixed up young teen. She wasn't even of age, but all of a sudden it was a way for her to make her own money. And so I think there's probably a lot of young people that get caught up in similar circumstances, especially if they, they get into drugs. And, oh, youth addiction. I mean, it's something that, I still don't know a lot about. I wish I'd known more 25 years ago. But it's still very confusing for parents to sort of go through all that. And I'm sure that there's many, many young people out there that are sort of experimenting with that alternative culture. And it's an easy way to make money. And it, like Andrea said, it can be exciting at first. It can be, oh, I don't even know. I just the whole thing is just so bizarre that I have trouble even imagining it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that what happens is often, I mean, this might sound like a cliche at this point, but I think it's a cliche because it's so common, which is that, you know, there's drug use involved and the men or young men in the situation pimp out their girlfriends because that's a way to make money for the drugs, or encourage their girlfriends to, you know, go out and sell sex, because at a certain point, if you're deep in your addiction, I think it becomes that or crime.
Yeah, exactly. And so you become part of, you know, you become a supporting member of the group in which you belong. And if you're, you know, if you're with a bunch of kids that want to do drugs, and then you can be the hero of the night and bring in a few $100s or whatever, then, you know, there's a temporary satisfaction in that, I guess. I don't know, as I say, I have trouble imagining the things that happened. Still, yeah, I had trouble then and I still have trouble now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people, I think, will say, well, if they don't want to be there, why don't they leave? You know, they're obviously staying because they like something about it, or they're making good money. Otherwise, why wouldn't they go do something else? And in fact, some of these women in pornography who act as sort of spokespeople for the industry, some of the kinds of women I mentioned earlier, will say, you know, like, I could do something else, but I like it. I've had great experiences. Again, I'm making good money. I was able to buy a house. But Andrea, can you talk about the sort of more complex reasons why women might stay in the sex industry, even if they've had bad experiences?
Oh yeah, that's a pretty loaded question, and I did write a paper called "The Instep Model: Insights from Sex Trade Experienced Persons," and that paper offers a theoretical model about exiting and kind of the mental journey that a lot of sex sellers of varying autonomy levels go through during their time in the industry. And so, in that model, which again, I'll reference it because it kind of helps to frame it, there's three levels of agency, if you will, among sellers. And so level one are trafficked people. They, I don't believe, ever really fully get into the industry and see it as a form of labor and have a great time. There are some, of course, that are the exception, who are really manipulated and come to view their exploitation as their own choice. But a lot of them, when it's quite severe situations of trafficking, I don't think that they actually get to that point. Level three on the opposite end is what we would call the sex worker identifying person. And those are the people who, no matter what you tell them, no matter what you try to open their eyes to about bigger picture thinking and how the industry as a whole is quite exploitative and negative for women, they won't ever see it as anything but labor. And a lot of those people are very autonomous and do make very high incomes and have never experienced any third-party exploitation. So I don't think that many of them will ever change their minds. But I think in the middle is the majority of people. And that's what I have referred to as level two providers. And those are the people who are there based on need of money for the most part. And really, they don't have someone, you know, holding them captive or taking their money as a third party profiteer outside of maybe a licensed brothel system or an agency. But they're not the pimped or trafficked individuals. And so for the level two providers, they really journey along a bell curve. They start at a very low point of, you know, having debts and struggles, and then they can only see up in the industry. Everything is looking great. There's a lot of money to be made. There's a lot of, hey, I can set my own hours. I have all this freedom. It's going to be great. And they begin the upward climb. And then eventually they, you know, take on a lot of bad experiences, negative things happen, and they then reach the tipping point and start heading down into what I call the negative active stage. And that's where they're still active, but now they're having a negative experience in the industry. So incurring trauma, experiencing struggles with addiction. And I think that that's really where the mind shift happens with in regards to looking at the industry and wanting to exit. So when people are these level two, you know, semi-autonomous providers, and they're on the climb, they're on the upward descent or upward ascension, nothing really kind of can reach those individuals at that point in their journey. So you could say to them, you know, you're being exploited, or this is not conducive to your well-being, and they just won't hear it, right? They're still in active justification stages and rationalizing what is happening, because there's that feel good dopamine hit of the big money particularly, and as well as things like, you know, the what they believe is the respect from the men and the admiration from the men who are in fact harming them. But once they head into that negative active stage, that's where really a lot of those justifications fall off. And so whenever we say like, oh, women, you know, are reluctant to leave the industry, I always say it's really just where they are in the journey. Because the women who are in the negative active stage and they want to exit, they desire to exit, but maybe just can't yet, there's really nothing that's manipulating them or lying to them, including themselves anymore. At that point, they do want to exit. So sometimes I think it's not looking at what we're telling ourselves, but where we are in the journey and what naturally is what we think at that point based on our level of autonomy.
Right. And I know that a lot of people would like to differentiate between what they might call, you know, consenting women, consenting adults, and trafficking. I think clearly the situation is more complex than that. But do you see trafficking as a specific entity, something separate from, say, prostitution? I'm troubled as to how to even define trafficking, because I think that trafficking is more complex than, say, you know, kidnapping a girl and bringing her to another country. But we also need to engage with legal terms. Kathy, how do you define trafficking? Do you use that word? Do you use that language?
I think that's a different reality, because I mean, I was just trying to think of the quote, the trafficking is the vehicle, prostitution is the destination. And I think I've talked to someone who repeats that to me several times because that was her reality. So, I mean, we also know that there's labor trafficking, which is not so much common in North America, but is certainly happens around the world. So trafficking is a much broader term that involves involving people against their will to do, you know, to provide servitude without reimbursement. So trafficking for sexual exploitation can happen. It can happen forcefully, but what we also know is it happens a lot through pseudo intimacy, you know, that boyfriends end up trafficking their girlfriends, families end up trafficking their children sometimes, you know, so trafficking is certainly one of the ways in which people are involved in sexual exploitation. And then, but I was just thinking earlier when we were talking about like, and then there's the whole addiction thing. We haven't really talked that much about addiction, even in our book. But I mean, the people that Andrea were describing in the InStep model, addiction isn't, I mean, it may be part of their lives, but I think there's a whole range of exploited women as well that are addicted. And so whether the addiction is planted by the traffickers or whether they just end up becoming drug dependent as part of their experimentation as youth, then that becomes a motivating factor as well. So that speaks to vulnerability and unemployability and sort of this whole underground market, because the people that are drug involved are certainly not going to be eligible for licensed facilities. So, you know, the people who promote licensed facilities say that they're preventing people, they're rescuing people from the underground market, but in fact they're creating a difference. So the underground market will always exist for the more marginalized, for the more unemployable, for the, you know, for the more desperate women. So there's just so many levels of entry, I think. And I mean, trafficked is certainly one.
Andrea, why do men buy sex? Is it because they're all lonely?
I was like, oh my gosh, you're giving me all the hard questions here that I need like an hour to pull apart in full.
I know, it's a really hard, complex conversation to have, especially within an hour.
Yeah.
We'll do our best.
Yeah. Well, I have done some podcast discussions before where I kind of talk about different groups of buyers, but you know, it's interesting, the more that I read other women's accounts and I hear more and engage with former buyers, I really start to see that just like women, there isn't really a simple way to group them truly, because they all are just so unique in what brings them there. And I think, you know, Kathy can attest to that as well as a woman alongside myself who presents at the Sex Trade Offender Program, the John School, that every time we present to the men, we hear different reasons. And there certainly is the same, you know, foundational aspects that they speak to. So like you said, loneliness, wanting something with no strings attached, having failing romantic relationships, boredom. We often hear boredom, which is a really weird one. We're like, you know, if you're bored, like go get a gym membership or go take up a hobby. Like, and ironically enough,
kill me as an excuse because I have yeah. zero sympathy for anybody who tells me they're ever bored. I'm like, I wish I had 800 more hours in the day because there's so many things I want to do and you're bored.
Same. Well, and what's weird about it too is like, you know, when we say to them, if you're bored, go get a hobby. If you log on to the escort review boards, the habitual sex buyers that frequent those boards actually call themselves hobbyists.
Yeah.
So, you know, sickening really when you think about it, that going and using your money to coerce women into one-sided sexual exchanges is suddenly your hobby. It's like collecting bodies, really. It's quite dark, but
yeah,
there's just so many reasons why men buy sex, and really none of them are warranted. They really aren't, because, you know, we have this, obviously within a patriarchal society, we have this argument somehow that we see replayed over and over, where people believe that, you know, men are entitled to sexual access with another person's body. And it's like, you know, yes, sex is a beautiful thing. It's a deep human connection. We all desire it, most of us, you know, but really we have to move away from this sense of entitlement that comes with sex, especially mm-hmm. from men. And so, you know, originally with our book, Kathy and I had planned to just name it Buying Sex, Who Really Pays? And then we sat down and we kind of talked about it, and we said, you know, it's kind of going back to like what she said earlier about intimate partner violence. Like, we have to actually turn around and name the problem. It's just like talking about violence against women. We need to start using the term male violence against women. Mm-hmm. So it was really important for us to change the title of the book to say, When Men Buy Sex, Who Really Pays? Because it has to come down to that. And I know a lot of men feel very targeted and, you know, villainized. Mm-hmm. But we have to really start saying to them, we're not coming for you. We're coming for your behavior. You have the choice to continue engaging in this behavior, or you have the choice to stop. So if you don't want to be vilified and attached to this behavior, mm-hmm. change your ways, start respecting women, really is the bottom line.
I wonder, you know, is there any scenario where paying for sex could be ethical? I mean, is there a hypothetical situation where a woman agrees to be paid for a sex act that's not unethical to your mind? Kathy, maybe you can respond.
Theoretically, if it was a fully informed choice between two partners of equal social and economic status, then I would say yes, it is theoretically possible. Just as anything is theoretically possible. The reality is that it very, very, very seldom happens. And that's one of the problems we we get into, or that even the legal system gets into. If they base the law on hypothesis, it neglects, pardon me, paying attention to the more profound reality. So again, theoretically, theoretically fully informed, two partners of equal social and economic status. But that very, very, very seldom happens.
What do you think, Andrea?
You know, I, going back to my instep model, I had quoted someone, I believe in that article, or maybe I had just said it myself, that exactly what Kathy said, you know, if everything is right on level playing field, sure. And I think even Rachel Moran had spoke to that before and kind of said, you know, we talk about this, but we don't really look that, you know, most of the time that's not the situation. So how can it be equal when it wasn't two equal parties coming together off the hop? But I think I've actually kind of changed my mind on that, which it's always interesting. Like, even in that article, I use the term service provider, which I would die, you know, to use today. I would never use that term. And that just goes to show, you know, it's only been 3 years since that paper was published. And so much of what I think has already changed and shifted with additional information and exposure. But the reason why I say that my mind has actually changed on that is when you really, and I actually posted about this on Twitter today, ironically, but when you look at the definition of sexual consent, the number one main requirement is that it be freely given. So free of any form of coercion. So even when a woman, say, is completely equal to a man in regards to her social status, her income, her, you know, net worth, if you will, there's still a coercive component that says, I am giving you money for you to have sex with me. And so for sexual consent to require it being freely given, right away, the money just nullifies that completely. And so I've actually changed my mind on it. I don't think that there is an ethical way whatsoever for sex to be purchased.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like I've gone back and forth on that question too. And that probably in the past I've said things like, you know, if you know, a woman's happy and fine and choosing it and she enjoys this work, then great, fine, whatever. But I've sort of come back to a place where I think it's just unethical on its face ever. I think there's probably situations that are more exploitative than other situations, yeah. And certainly more abusive and more criminal than other situations, you know, when we're talking mm-hmm. about minors. But I do think that it's, you know, I think that sex should be about mutuality. And I think that so long that there is an exchange of money, that mutuality goes away, because, I mean, what it does signal is that the woman wouldn't be doing it otherwise. Because I think, I mean, Kaisa Ekis Ekman makes this argument, so we want to credit her for that. You know, if these two people are really into each other and really passionate and really want to have sex, then they'll just do that. There doesn't need to be money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder, what is it that deters men from buying sex? I mean, is it you change their minds about what the reality is? You somehow manage to teach them empathy. You convince them that these women don't want to be there, that they're troubled, or, you know, what is it? Is it possible to change a John or to stop men from buying sex when they want to do that?
Maybe I'll just start with that, if that's okay, Kathy.
Sure.
I strongly believe Johns can be reformed. I don't believe that is a universal concept. I think that there are some people who are narcissistic and who are sociopaths. You know, sadists that just get off on hurting others. But I think, you know, when we look at who the John is, he is the everyman, typically. And I guess maybe I just want to maintain some hope and some faith that men, by large, are empathetic, caring, loving, that they don't want to intentionally hurt someone. And, but one thing I think that has really saddened me is that although there are a few men who do stop purchasing sex because they hear of the harm that it brings upon the seller, I have learned that the vast, vast majority of men quit purchasing sex for selfish reasons. So some type of reason that centers back to them and the impact of buying sex on them rather than the exploited person. So usually that's them feeling monetarily exploited, emotionally exploited, running the risk of being arrested or discovered by their employer or their spouse, believing that, you know, the woman actually cared about them and learning, you know, that she didn't. So really that's kind of what I notice is that selfishness, just as a lot of times it's the selfishness that leads them towards purchasing sex and the industry as a whole, it's also typically selfish reasoning that gets them out of the industry. So, you know, that to me is just very discouraging, because it kind of makes me challenge my idea that they are empathetic beings who care about women and want equality. But I do like to think that, you know, later on, after the selfish reasoning has removed them and they are out of their ego space, that's when then they are more receptive to hearing the stories of the people that they have impacted and harmed. And then they can empathize with that. They're kind of out of that blinder role, if you will, of the narrow focus. So, yeah, that's just kind of my observations that I've seen, which have been encouraging and discouraging at the same time.
Yeah. And I mean, probably one of the primary deterrents is legislation. I mean, like you said, fear of something bad happening to them. I mean, Kathy, what do you know about deterring men from buying sex or stopping Well, reducing the demand, let's say.
I think that the whole education and awareness applies to men as well. So having spoken now, I mean, again, I'm coming from a different perspective, but having spoken to about 3,000 Johns over the last 25 years, most of them get it at the and this is an 8-hour program. So they you know, John School is an 8-hour program where they learn about the legislation, they learn about sexually transmitted diseases, they learn about trafficking, they learn about community impact, they hear first person stories, and then they are also challenged to look at their own motivations. So it's a very intense, what they say is that at the end of the day, we have the guys stand up and sort of share what they have learned. And some of them have said things like, nobody ever told me this before, you know. And I remember one guy says, I was obviously thinking with the wrong head, you know, and they will say, and most of them, well, at least half of them will honestly thank us. You know, they come in begrudgingly, you know, looking down at the floor, not wanting to acknowledge anybody. But at the end of the day, most of them seem to be genuine, and they'll thank us for a new perspective. They'll thank us for opening their eyes. They'll thank us for, sharing the bigger picture. They thank us for, you know, having personalizing, I guess, the people that they're using. And I think that stays with them. So, yes, I'm sure. And I think even Victor Malarek said it's half and half, you know, that half of them are motivated through empathy, and the other half are, it kind of scares them into realizing the dangers of sexually transmitted diseases, the danger of being, being found out by your employer, being, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So it's, I think it's, I don't know. This is not a statistical response. It's just an intuitive response. I'd say it's about half and half of empathy versus fear. So the legislation in and of itself, I think it would be totally incomplete without education. So we really need to, like, don't be that guy. We need to have that kind of education going out to sort of counterbalance the whole pornography that's become so predominant as part of our society, which just creates the whole mystique of, you know, the purpose in life is sexual pleasure. And so we need to broaden people's perspectives and have them look at, what does it really mean to be a man? What does it mean to be an empathetic man? What does it mean to be a caring man? What does it mean to be a faithful man? You know, what does it mean? All of those kinds of things. What is it, you know, what does it mean if you're in a relationship with a woman? Because so many, there's always a few that will say that they were seeking out, they were seeking to buy sex because that didn't count. You know, they wanted to be faithful to their partner, but, you know, if you bought it, it didn't really count because it wasn't really a relationship. So there's just education on so, so many, many levels that needs to happen. And it needs to happen at high school, you know, where these kids are told that this is what they need to sort of explore what human relationships mean and what does it mean to be in a positive relationship with the opposite sex or the same sex even, and you know, how do you build positive relationships and positive feelings? And we just know that the whole pornography is so objectified and so superficial, and it is also addictive. I mean, we also know that as young people get exposed to pornography before their minds are fully developed, it becomes an addictive cycle that's hard to break, and that's discouraging as well. So there's just so much education that's needed over and above or as part of legislation.
Right, and I think empathy is such a key part of this, and I think that pornography discourages empathy in very obvious ways. If you look at the way the women are treated in porn, it's as though they're less than human, and they're degraded and humiliated intentionally, and treated as though their feelings, both physical and psychologically, don't matter or don't even exist. I mean, obviously, when you're doing things to somebody that are painful, But it's giving somebody else pleasure that's going to decrease empathy. And I've talked to a lot of men about pornography, and I've changed the minds of men about pornography, and I've known men who've stopped watching pornography, and there's all sorts of different reasons why they do that. Sometimes it's selfish, sometimes they don't want to lose their relationship. But often it's about understanding what's happening on the other side of the camera, or it's about understanding how it's impacting their own views and relationships to women. You included a number of experiential voices in the book. What were some of the more powerful or perhaps disturbing stories you encountered in doing this research?
I want to say that I think all of them are uniquely powerful in their own way. I was thinking about that because I actually thought that that might be a question that you would have. And I thought, oh, you know, she might ask kind of about some of these experiential voices and what they share. And it's, I think between the 10 accounts that we have, the contributions that these women all gave firsthand through their own writing is just takes you on a journey in and of itself. You know, our book is 4 parts prior to that. And then we move into part 5, which is our experiential voices. And I really want to say that those voices alone could be a book just in and of themselves, very similar to Prostitution Narratives by Caroline Norma and Melinda Tankard Reist. Great book. And really there's so much power in story, because we can talk theory, we can touch on all these abstract concepts that are very objective, but when you actually hear these firsthand accounts, there's something in each one of them that will reach different people in different ways. So I know that I could probably list, you know, 2 or 3 that really moved me more than a few of the others, and Kathy could probably do the same, and they might not even be the same contributions. So I think that we have a really good diverse perspective that these 10 individuals completely wrap up themselves just together so neatly as one, that I really think that that's a very big strength to our book and has just so much power to it.
Right. I was going to say they touch on everything from like a young one woman who was sexually abused she was basically groomed in her family. She was told as a young girl, what was it? You're sitting on a gold mine. Yeah, you're sitting on a gold mine. You'll never be hungry. You know, so when you're indoctrinated that way as a small child by a family who has obviously been marginalized and taught that that is one way of survival, to women who have been, the one girl who was exploited by her so-called boyfriend, who was just totally blindsided, went on a trip with her boyfriend and was, you know, basically put to work, to some of the women who were sought out for financial reasons. So it's a diversity. And I was going to say, yes, we sort of, the book really is a channel for the experiential voices, because without the experiential voices, it's just theory. And so, I mean, there's a number of experiences embodied in the first 16 chapters, but we're heavy on theory, but we wanted to include the experiential voices to sort of, you know, give life to the theory. Does that make sense? Yeah.
And your book is going to be out soon. When will it be available, and how can people find it?
Well, that's a million-dollar question right there, because we want to know that too.
I wish we had an answer.
Yeah,
we'll have to interview someone else.
Yeah,
to find
we need
out.
To talk to our publisher and get those hard dates. But I think we're aiming right now for mid to late June. Yes. We were hoping for a bit sooner, but we really don't want to put out something that isn't perfect. Both Kathy and I are perfectionists to our core, as I know you are as well, Megan. And I think, you know, this is a very, very sensitive subject as well. So yes, we want to make sure that what we're saying is very concise, you know, not leaving any room for misunderstanding or, you know, any way for someone to misconstrue it. Well, and so we really want to be clear. And so that's our goal, but we'll see.
It's a long process, eh? You think you get through it just by writing it, but you don't.
Yeah, so people say, how's the book coming? And I said, well, it's not our job. And like, we've done what we can do. It's other people's responsibility now. But I mean, there's many, many steps that we still have to approve. Whether it can still, theoretically, it can still happen in 3 months.
And
March, April, May, June. Yeah, so we're hoping.
Too. I mean, it's so important. It's really hard to find good information about the sex trade. There are a lot of voices. There's a lot of people talking about the sex industry, talking about porn, talking about prostitution. But in terms of the reality, I think it's really hard to find any kind of truth about that, partly because there's a lot of different truths. You know, there are a lot of different experiences and different facets of the trade.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a very tiny minority that we hear about of voices, stories, people. And I'm glad that we're talking about Canada, because I hadn't really realized, yes, to be honest, that there was a threat to our current legislation. I did know that it wasn't being enforced. So I thought that was the fight, to get the government to enforce those laws, which would be a reason to try to get the Liberals out. The NDP are of no help either. What do you two think we should be doing now? I mean, if we're headed towards decriminalization, honestly, that's a big concern.
Oh, it's a terrible big concern.
I think that we need to change public opinion. That's really, I think, the spirit of our book. Yeah. was written with the understanding that the public is, you know, of really no major fault of their own, just ignorant to this topic, because they too have fallen prey to sex work ideology conditioning on a very mass social level through media and popular culture. Yeah. So I think for us, we, knowing that we have this threat to our legislation, it's so important to get the public to A, understand this subject, and B, get on our side, so that they can start reaching out to their members of parliament and start, you know, raising a fuss about this and saying women deserve better than to be purchasable market commodities in our country, which is not conducive to gender equality. So yeah, that's really, to me, the public, the social conditioning, the bigger conversation is so important. So that's why we're really, you know, racing to get this book out in time for people to be able to purchase it, absorb it, and then act on it with their MPs.
Yeah, there's just so many levels. I think we need to introduce when we're talking about language, Julie, one of the languages that I've come up with lately that I've been discussing with somebody is the blowjob economy, you know, and just to say things like women deserve better than being relegated to a blowjob economy. You know, you have to say, as much as I don't like using derogatory words, we have to use words that get people's attention. And I mean, to me, that says it pretty bluntly. And then I was thinking the other day, maybe it's sort of like smoking. I mean, smoking isn't criminalized, but the whole public education has shifted over the last, you know, 15 years, is that very, very few people smoke anymore, even though it's still legal, you know. So that's the kind of effort that I think we need to put into the whole sexual exploitation, is that it needs, the awareness needs to be there. The prohibitions need to be there. The restrictions around availability need to be there. That kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's unfortunate, because it sort of shows that if legislation is passed, but it doesn't actually have the support of the government or the majority, I suppose, it's not going to do very well, because it, you know, the Nordic model has been very successful in Sweden, but I think that it had government support, and it now certainly has population, you know, support from the general population, although that was that grew on account of public education. So all of that stuff needs to happen, and it's maddening that the government won't get behind this, but hopefully we can work on that.
Yes, I mean, we probably will have a government change again in a couple years, but all of the same issues will remain. You know, it's going to take a while to fire up the whole population about the issue, because I think people are just lulled into non-action by this whole idea of, oh well, don't people agree? And I guess this is what's so interesting. So right now, this is what kind of concerns. This is a good bad thing. So everybody gets together and agrees that we're anti-trafficking. So all of the NDP and the city of Edmonton, and, you know, we were at an event a while ago where everybody's standing in a group and smiling, and they're all agreeing that we're anti-trafficking. Well, whoopee, because, you know, the mayor of Edmonton who licenses brothels is anti-trafficking. The NDP member of parliament who is anti-PSEPA is anti-trafficking.
Nobody's pro-trafficking. So, no one is pro-trafficking. it's such a ridiculous position to take.
So because we've created this whole new anti-trafficking, that's where everybody's energy is going. And so then nobody's looking at, well, what else is there? If people aren't trafficked, what about the rest of the people? Like, and so the assumption is that, oh, well, everybody else is okay with it. You know, so as long as we can take out the people that are trafficked, then everybody's going to be happy. And so that's the danger of this whole anti-trafficking movement. In my mind, I mean, yes, it's nice that we're focusing on trafficking, but oh my goodness, what is if we don't have trafficking, what do we have? And the answer is we have decrim, and that's really, really scary. And that's the biggest distraction, as I see it right now, is the anti-trafficking lobby is in fact indirectly supporting the decrim model.
I thank you both so much for talking with me about all this. I think that we could have talked for many more hours, but it's the evening now, so I'll let you go. Is there somewhere that people can find you online, and in particular if they want to sort of follow the progress of the book so that they can check it out when it comes out?
Well, I think I can be found where I'm always on 24/7, it feels like, some days, which is
our
Twitter.
Favorite place.
Our favorite place. Love it there. The best place in the world. Yes. I'm still trying to get Kathy on there, but, you know, no luck yet. But
I hate it.
She's so ridiculous.
I don't know. I may be past the, yeah. I'm not sure I'm a Twitter candidate. But no doubt we will be launching when we're clear to launch. We will be doing a massive launch where we will be notifying everybody that's on every Facebook page and every friend of friend, and we'll be letting everybody know when it's available. We're already sort of tentatively planning what we can do as a launch, and that'll just be the first step. So we have lots of ideas for once the book is out, how we're going to continue to spread the word.
Alrighty. Sounds good. And for those listening, and I'll include these links in the show notes. Also, you can find Andrea at Hindsight 2020 on Twitter. Again, thank you so much for your time and all of your hard work. It is so, so important.
Thank you so much for having us, Megan. It's great to be able to discuss this. And one final note for people that don't know, all proceeds, or all profits, I should say, of our book will be going to end demand efforts in Canada. So charities and organizations and initiatives. So we really look forward to having the support of as many people as possible so that we can give back to the community and make some change.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy. We have been ad-free, sponsorship-free, wealthy investor-free, and fully independent since 2012. If you enjoyed this podcast, and if you value independent women's media, by women, for women, no compromises, please consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.